what's been shown is that there's this pool of cells in the center of the spinal cord that has stem cell-like properties. So they have the potential under the right conditions to replace other cells. And what we see is that after spinal cord injury, they become activated. So they're normally quiet. And then after an injury state, they become activated to become other cells. And so that's kind of like the body's own way of trying to protect the cord or have a positive response to that injury.
This is Your Complex Brain, a podcast all about the brain, the diseases that impact it, and the path to finding cures. I'm your host, Heather Sherman, and I have the great pleasure of working alongside the team at the Kremble Brain Institute in Toronto, Canada, a leader in brain research and patient care. In each episode, we'll take you behind the scenes into our clinics and research labs to meet the game changers of the future. We'll empower you with the latest research to help you take charge of your own health. You'll also hear from people who are living with brain disease, as well as their loved ones and the care teams who support them. Join us on a journey to unravel the mystery of your complex brain. The year is 1995. Actor Christopher Reeve is injured in a horseback riding accident, leaving him quadriplegic, paralyzed from the shoulders down. He became a tireless advocate and a passionate supporter of research. Christopher's dream was for those living with spinal cord injuries to have a better quality of life, and one day, to walk again. More than 25 years later, thanks to advances in surgical approaches, neuroprotective drugs, and gene therapy using stem cells, that dream is becoming closer to reality. And that is welcome news for the more than 86,000 Canadians who are currently living with some form of spinal cord injury, including John Ruffalo. Here is his story.
I'm John Ruffalo, founder and managing partner of an investment firm called Mavericks Private Equity, and I have been a longtime investor in both venture capital and private equity. September of 2020, on the day of the accident, I'm actually gearing up for the first close of my new growth private equity fund. And on a gorgeous day, like I've done many other days, went from my house and went for a nice solo cycling ride. I went solo because it was during COVID, and it was a 100-kilometer ride from my house in Toronto to north of Toronto, and kind of a loop to Stouffville, about 5 kilometers away from my midpoint of the destination. I heard a very loud truck. I suspected it was an 18-wheeler. Right on the tail of my back tire, which is very troubling and a fear of many cyclists, just before I could react, the truck had hit me. It was going about 80 to 90 kilometers an hour, hit my back, obliterated my vertebrae, and sent me flying for a secondary impact quite far away from the first impact. In the benefit of hindsight, I didn't know, but I had about an hour to get to hospital or I would pass away. Ambulance was there very quickly, and I was awake during the whole ride in an ambulance, and they got me to hospital in about 25 minutes. And then I was immediately induced into a coma and spent the next 6 days or so in a coma. I didn't have any surgery for the first 36 hours. There was a big fear that the trauma of the surgery would be a third impact on my body, and my body may not be able to have absorbed that impact. By the time it hit the 36-hour mark, then they made the decision to perform 2 surgeries. They did my pelvic surgery first. My pelvis was split into 6 pieces. All of my ribs were broken in multiple places on one side of my body, damaged organs, you name it. But the pelvis was the complicated surgery. So I first did that surgery, and then they rotated me and then did the surgery on my back. And the combined surgery was about 15 hours. I've had some serious cycling crashes before, but I've been able to bounce right back up. On this one here, I immediately knew I was paralyzed from the waist down. And there's this feeling of nothingness. I could wiggle my fingers, I could move my head, but I couldn't do anything below my waist. So I already knew. After I had gotten out of the coma after about the sixth day and the intubation was removed, I did ask the nurse what was the prognosis, and I was diagnosed with the worst grading of a spinal cord injury. It's called an ASIA A, which basically means you are a complete spinal cord victim and you'll never ever have use of your legs again, which obviously is a shock to anyone to hear that. After a few weeks of being in hospital, so I was at hospital at Sunnybrook, I then had a meeting with Dr. Failings, and they had me do some initial tests, you know, MRI, etc. And Dr. Failings had concluded that in order to maximize my functional recovery, he thought that I should get my spinal cord decompressed. He said it's a very, very complicated surgery. There is a lot of risk with that surgery. Very few people know how to do it because of the sensitivity. And I said, what are the odds of success? And he said, odds have been around 50-50. And I told him, I am a venture capitalist. I'm in the 1% odds game. 50-50 is ginormous for me. And he's like, do you want to think about it? And my wife and I both said, nope, let's do it. And 3 weeks later, we removed the pins and the rods in my back and another 7-hour surgery. He removed all of the fragments and rebuilt my vertebrae with the bone fragments that were remaining, and then reinserted the rods and the screws, and the surgery was a success, and my spine was decompressed. So for the first 2 months, I'm really in still the acute care. So first at Sunnybrook and then at Toronto Western. Then you go into a rehab stage, and I went to Toronto Lyndhurst. And there you're really just recuperating. My body just needed lots of time to heal. And at the same time, I really started needing to commence physio. My body started recalling the memory in my spinal cord of certain movements in my body. And the funny thing is, my body started to recall the movements of cycling before it did on walking. I am still officially designated as a complete ASIA A, and yet I cycle and walk daily. Now, not unaided, but I'm walking and pedaling. If you were to ask Dr. Failings and some of the other doctors, they are shocked at the amount of recovery that I've experienced. And one of the factors is I believe, and so does Dr. Failings believe, the decompression has enabled me to increase my chances for a recovery. But I also have, on top of that, undergone massive amount of physical therapy, which is really today the only known treatment to at least improve your situation, not to necessarily solve it, but to give you a life that could become bearable. What I had been told was, you will see your recovery in the first 6 to 12 months, but by the end of 12 months or thereabouts, your recovery period is over and you're not going to really experience any improvements in terms of your functionality. Well, I discovered that's not true. It takes a lot of time and money. It's unfortunate on the post-acute care, there's not a lot of significant resources available to you. So one of the things that I have been fortunate is that I did 4 months after my accident, I did go back to work. My physio routine is 7 days a week, about 18 to 20 hours a week without stopping, and I am still improving. And I am getting stronger both on my pedaling. My walking is getting stronger and more independent, but it's still not fully independent. And the reason why I think people underestimate the power of physio and your neuroplasticity is that you have to be extremely stubborn or stupid or both to want to continue to go through the pain and the discipline that I need to go through to continue doing this. After 6 to 12 months of constant physio, you really want to get on with your life. And I think I've made physio a part of my daily life. When the accident occurred, I was querying whether a solution would be available in my lifetime. And a year goes by, and the amount of research and knowledge is growing at a logarithmic pace. And what's interesting is part of the challenge is not necessarily the technology per se, but it's rather the communication amongst the global community of projects that others are doing and people not being aware of the project. I think we're in between a 5 and 10 year time frame, possibly, to actually both partially, for sure, and perhaps wholly solving spinal cord injury. And that's where I'm mostly focused in on. My message is one of hope and never to take away the hope. I understand now, I didn't before, how easily it could get you into a dark place the moment you lose hope. It was my message to the hospitals as well. And I said to them, hey, just a little bit of piece of advice. And I know that you have to manage expectations, but there's a fine line on managing expectations and removing hope. Do not cross the line of removing hope. My message to folks is, I believe that something very significant will occur within the next 10 years. But every year I've been cutting the estimate by half. And I hope to be saying a year from now, boy, was I wrong. It's going to be within the next 5 years. The one thing that you can do is get physio right now and get your body moving and allow your body to feel the movements again and hopefully have technology to give you that extra boost to get some more functionality.
My guests today are on the forefront of truly pivotal and pioneering research in spinal cord injury. Dr. Laureen Hatcham is a neurosurgery resident and PhD candidate at UHN's Kremble Brain Institute and the University of Toronto. She's joined by her supervisor, Dr. Michael Failings, a senior scientist at the Kremble Brain Institute and a professor of neurosurgery at U of T. Dr. Failings also holds the Campo Tatter Chair in Brain and Spinal Cord Research. Welcome, and thank you both for joining me today on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for having us.
We heard earlier from a patient, John Ruffalo, who is living with a spinal cord injury, and I know you're both familiar with John's story. What does it feel like to hear a story like John's firsthand and truly understand what some of the biggest challenges are for patients living with spinal cord injury? Dr. Hatcham?
Yeah, I really think stories like John's, I think he's a remarkable individual, and kind of his persistence and perseverance on his road to recovery is really an inspiration to both us as care providers and other patients. And I think that really it is the heart of what we do, both from a clinical standpoint and research-wise. We're trying to find cures for patients that sustain these injuries. And I think it really is a driving force as to why we're all here doing the work.
I would echo Laureen's comments and maybe add a few of my own. John is certainly one of the most determined, remarkable individuals that I've ever met. And, you know, I really take inspiration from people I've taken care of with spinal cord injury. And John is an exceptional individual. He's had a remarkable drive to push his recovery. And he and I have gone on a journey together in terms of undertaking decompressive surgery, which has helped Mr. Ruffalo in terms of his recovery. But John also, his story really tells us the limits of what we can do with surgery and the tremendous need to pursue improved treatments through regenerative neuroscience.
And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about today. So in terms of the momentum that we've seen in spinal cord injury research and care in the last 25 years, 30 years, can you set the stage for us, Dr. Failing, since you first entered this field? What are some of the biggest advances and what are some of the most promising advances?
Probably 90% of what we now know related to spinal cord injury and regenerative neuroscience has been learned in the last 2 to 3 decades. So we now have a better understanding of the mechanisms that cause cell death after a traumatic spinal cord injury, the concept that the primary mechanical trauma incites what's referred to as a secondary injury, which is provoked by damage to the blood vessels and ischemia and cellular toxic events. And we've been able to develop surgical strategies to decompress the spinal cord that have had a dramatic impact on people's outcomes. And there also have been efforts to develop so-called neuroprotective strategies to attenuate the extent of cell injury. When I was a student, it was said that the central nervous system cannot regenerate, and that once someone has an injury such as a severe traumatic spinal cord injury, that's it. We now have a much better understanding, and what's emerged over the last several decades is a new area of science referred to as regenerative neuroscience, where we have learned to overcome inhibitory factors in the central nervous system to induce regeneration. And we've also been learning how to activate endogenous stem cells, as well as to have improved techniques to deliver exogenous stem cells.
Can you expand on that, Dr. Hatcham? Because I know that's a big focus of your work.
Yeah, so some of the work that I've been doing in the lab has been focusing on this endogenous pool of neural stem cells. And essentially, a stem cell is a type of cell that's not yet committed to a mature cell, like a neuron that we know is critical for signaling, or glial cells that support the neurons to do their job. And so what's been shown is that there's this pool of cells in the center of the spinal cord that has stem cell-like properties. So they have the potential under the right conditions to replace other cells. And what we see is that after spinal cord injury, they become activated. So they're normally quiescent or quiet. And then after an injury state, they become activated to become other cells. And so that's kind of like the body's own way of trying to protect the cord or have a positive response to that injury. What we see, though, is their numbers are not sufficient, and this is largely restricted to a very early time point post-injury. So some of the work we've been looking at is how can we understand those early mechanisms of their activation so that we can now either prolong their activation state or start to modulate them or change them in subacute or chronic, so months out from the injury, and get maybe another reactivation to help with regeneration or cellular replacement. So a lot of the work I've been doing in the lab has been looking at what are those early mechanisms. And interestingly, what we found kind of discovery earlier in my work was that some of the toxic chemicals that are released after injury, the ones that kill off the neurons and other cells, are potentially the ones that might be activating these cells. So we kind of term that the glutamate paradox, glutamate being one of those chemicals. And so now we're looking at how we can use those mechanisms. I've been looking at a drug that kind of modulates glutamate receptors, specifically AMPA receptors, and how we can now translate that understanding of the mechanism into a therapy that's clinically relevant. So a pharmacological agent that we've been studying, and now we can now apply that in subacute or chronic injury to try to reactivate these cells.
It's really an exciting time, and really the era of regenerative neuroscience has emerged. And what we have learned is that the center of the spinal cord is the key to the regenerative response. And the center of the spinal cord is where stem cells reside in people's spinal cords. The challenge right now, though, is that the number of so-called endogenous stem cells is quite limited. And while stimulating people's own regenerative response is very exciting and at the cutting edge of research, from a more practical perspective, we are looking at the concept of transplants of so-called neural stem cells. And neural stem cells are the developmental building block of the whole central nervous system. And we now have techniques where we can engineer a neural stem cell that's customized for the person themselves. We can take any cell from their body, for example, a skin cell, and using a technique called induced pluripotent stem cell engineering, turn that cell, called a somatic cell, into a customized neural stem cell. And then we can now go even beyond that, where we can use a technique called CRISPR-Cas9 genetic engineering to put in molecules into those neural stem cells to modify the environment in a customized fashion. So, for example, to break down the scar tissue that forms in a chronic injury. And so these are very, very exciting developments that are occurring in regenerative neuroscience.
Amazing. And are there certain subsets of patients, Dr. Hatcham, that would benefit the most from regenerative therapy or gene therapy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think at this stage, from a research stage, it's relatively early to know which therapy will target or benefit which subset of patients, but that does really open the door to the whole concept of there's a lot of heterogeneity in patients. And so we're seeing this from a clinical perspective, both traumatic spinal cord injury and degenerative related or arthritis related injuries of the spine. We're seeing different trajectories or paths that patients take. Some have more recovery, some have less recovery. And it may not necessarily just be an injury related response. There could be some underlying factors in the patient. So I think this kind of opens the whole research world to understanding, you know, what genetic or molecular predispositions are there to someone's response to an injury. And I think understanding that from a very mechanistic or biological perspective will help us understand that clinical heterogeneity and then target those treatment strategies. I think from a regenerative standpoint, we do see most patients in a subacute or chronic setting. So obviously that's the time period we want to help regenerate those axons or those neuron signaling mechanisms.
So how does that work? I mean, you're on call, Dr. Failings, and a patient comes in with a spinal cord injury. Take us through the process a little bit about how you determine the extent of their injury and what they might be a candidate for in terms of therapy or treatment.
Yes. So from our work at the Crumbl Brain Institute in Toronto has emerged the concept that has now been universally adopted, which is time is spine, in that the timing of intervention is critical. So individuals who sustain a spinal cord injury will be transferred to a center such as the Toronto Western Hospital that specializes in the care of these individuals. They'll undergo a diagnostic examination using standardized neurological testing, and then there'll be advanced imaging, including CT and MRI, to document the extent of the injury. Most people with spinal cord injury sustain a fracture, and there's pressure on the spinal cord. And so we recommend that surgery be undertaken in individuals and optimally as soon as possible, where the spinal cord is decompressed and stabilized. And at the same time, individuals with a spinal cord injury are cared for in the intensive care unit by a multidisciplinary team. And one of the critical factors in the management is to augment the blood pressure artificially. And this is done often through drugs called inotropes. After the first week to two, most patients are ready to go to a rehabilitation facility, such as Lyndhurst, which is one of the largest spinal cord injury facilities in the world. It's part of UHM. And there, individuals will undergo targeted rehabilitation to try to enhance their underlying recovery and also learn approaches to regain some degree of independence. And this will vary depending on the severity of the injury. At around 2 to 3 months after an injury, we have a very good idea what the trajectory of outcome will be. Individuals with a spinal cord injury in 2024 have a dramatically different trajectory of outcome than they may have had 2 or 3 decades ago. So many, many more patients, such as Mr. Ruffalo, are having substantial recovery. But as John's case has also exemplified, despite the fact that substantial recovery occurs, many individuals are left with significant residual neurologic deficits. So this might involve loss of motor function, so challenges with walking and with transferring. Often people can have quite significant pain related to injury in the nervous system, and there can be impairments also in the control of the bowel and bladder function. And so at around 2 to 3 months after injury, if one has the sense that individuals are going to be left with substantial residual impairment, this is where you start considering the options of regenerative treatments. And individuals at around 3 to 6 months after injury are probably in the optimal time frame to receive regenerative technologies, although these are still now in evolution. And then after 6 months, the injury becomes chronic, largely because of the deposition of scar tissue. And through some major breakthroughs in our laboratory and in a few others around the world, we're learning ways to overcome the barrier of the scar tissue. And we can essentially convert a chronic injury back into a subacute injury where there's sufficient endogenous plasticity to allow some of these regenerative techniques to be effective.
And so some of these patients may have progressed to a point where, as you're saying, it may be a chronic injury or disability at that point, but you're actually able to reverse that in a way to bring them back to a point where they may be a candidate for some of these more innovative therapies?
Yes, and that's been one of the big breakthroughs that has occurred in our laboratory, is the ability to overcome the scarring in the spinal cord. And so this essentially converts a chronic injury back into a subacute injury where there's a much greater potential for regenerative techniques to be effective.
On the surgical front, Dr. Failings, we talked a little bit about early decompression surgery, also known as microsurgery, that was really pioneered here in Toronto at the Crumble Brain Institute at University Health Network. Can you just tell us a little bit more about it and just really how revolutionary it is for treating patients with spinal cord injury?
When I was a resident in training, individuals with a spinal cord injury would be told that their paralysis was permanent, nothing could be done, and often these individuals were put on bed rest or in traction for weeks to months. That has now changed with significant advances in imaging, surgery, anesthesia, and intensive care. We now have the techniques where we can surgically take the pressure off the spinal cord, it's called a decompression, and then we can stabilize the injured spinal column with implants. And studies pioneered by our unit, in particular the Staskis study published about a decade ago, showed that individuals who had surgery within 24 hours had dramatically improved outcomes. And this has now been adopted around the world with guidelines that will now be emerging.
We're hearing a lot in the news about a lot of different brain-powered implants and biomedical devices. We're hearing about Elon Musk's Neuralink and the Swiss pilot study looking at different implants for patients. So I really wanted to throw it out to both of you to help us kind of separate fact from fiction or science fiction, really. I mean, what is real and what is really going to help patients in the years to come? Dr. Failings?
We're in a remarkable era, and the science underlying electrical stimulation of the nervous system to evoke movement, the use of brain-computer interfaces. The science is there and it is real. The reality, however, is that these devices are still investigational and there is further research that needs to be done. So these devices do not represent a standard of care. This is not something that can be easily done and applied on a universal basis in all patients. But having said that, I do envision over the next 5 to 10 years that we will learn which patient will benefit the most from these devices, and there will be advances in the implementation of these implants. And we envision that the Toronto Western Hospital, UHN, will be at the forefront of these innovations. And one of the young researchers in our community, Dr. Newton Cho, who did his initial work in my laboratory and then subsequently went to Switzerland to work with Dr. Gregoire Courtin, has now brought these technologies back to Toronto. And we're very hopeful that Dr. Cho and other colleagues around the world will be able to advance this science from the level of early investigation to the clinical application in patients.
Dr. Hatcham, are you equally optimistic?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think things are still early in the investigational pipeline, but there is promise, I think, particularly with the stimulation therapies in terms of seeing an effect. I think ultimately, a lot of this will very likely be a synergistic kind of effect. So stimulation potentially with a pharmacological or drug therapy or rehab and other types of, you know, harnessing endogenous mechanisms as well. So I think time will tell which kind of strategy and which combinations might have the most effect, but it is likely that not just one single treatment would be the way.
And I would echo that concept of what we have referred to as combinatorial treatments. And this is where the art of medicine will link with the science of medicine. So knowing which combination of treatments to apply in an individual patient.
And that brings us to the term that comes up often in our world and often in a lot of our episodes, which is personalized medicine. I mean, would you ever have equated thinking about spinal cord injury in the context of being able to provide personalized medicine to patients?
Well, 3 decades ago, we had very few treatments that could be applied in spinal cord injury. And when you don't have a lot of treatments, it's hard to personalize treatments when they don't really exist. But now as treatments are starting to emerge, we have the ability to now customize the approaches that are correct for each individual. And I think where we are now in 2024, we are in the era of where personalized medicine approaches can be applied to individuals with a spinal cord injury.
Dr. Hatcham, you're part of the new generation of neurosurgeons that's going to be able to capitalize on all of these advances. How do you feel about that? How excited are you about the next 25, 30 years of research?
I think it is a really exciting time. I mean, I started actually in the lab with Dr. Tatter in 2009, and then now with Dr. Tatter and Dr. Failing. So even within that period of time, it's really exciting to see how far the field has progressed. So I think it, you know, and also with the advancements of different technologies, a lot of which I've started to incorporate in my research. So, you know, in collaborating with other teams, we've talked on this kind of podcast about, you know, the molecular, the biology, but then now opening up to kind of circuit level research, electrophysiological research, the whole transcriptomic side. So I've been fortunate in the lab to be able to integrate and collaborate with other labs doing those. So I think it really opens the doors and ultimately will hopefully facilitate us finding a treatment for patients with spinal cord injury.
We're talking about big advances, but Dr. Failings, you and I have talked before about, you know, even some of the small wins when it comes to spinal cord injuries and giving people quality of life back are important as well. So tell us a little bit about that in the context of these advances.
Yes, indeed, Heather, and you're absolutely right. And one of the things that I have learned from individuals with lived experience, such as John Ruffalo and others, is that what might appear to you and I as small effects can actually be a big deal. So for example, in an individual, say with an injury of the cervical spinal cord, where these people lose the ability to control their hands, recovery of hand function, even if people can't recover the ability to walk, can be a game changer. And so to you or I, this might appear to be a relatively small improvement, but to such an individual, it's a big improvement. And another example might be the ability to have better control of one's bowel and bladder. You know, this is something that most people just take for granted. It just sort of happens. But when you lose that function, it can have a big impact on your life. And so, again, this is an area where it might at first blush appear to be relatively minor. But to people with a spinal cord injury, this is a pretty big deal. And so that's one of the big lessons that I have learned from listening to people with spinal cord injuries, to pay attention to some of these details and to focus on these as well. And you don't necessarily have to have the big home run cure to be able to have an impact on people with spinal cord injury. And I think sometimes, you know, with difficult problems, it's more realistic and pragmatic to take a step-by-step approach and, you know, to try to advance improvements incrementally.
I've heard patients like John talk about the whole idea of hope and how important it is to always give patients hope. So can you tell us about that as a clinician and a scientist? How do you talk to patients about not losing hope despite the circumstances?
One of the most important things that I have learned from my patients, from people with lived experience who've had a spinal cord injury, is how important it is to have a sense of hopefulness. Hope is so important. And one thing that I've learned not to say to patients is that there cannot be any recovery. And the art is to provide a sense of hope to people who've sustained a severe injury, such as a spinal cord injury. And the art is to retain honesty, but to present the facts in a hopeful way. And the reality is that sometimes people can show much greater recovery than you might be able to consider. And in Mr. Ruffalo's case, I believe he may have been told that his injury was permanent and complete, and there was not a hope for recovery. And this is when I met him, and I gave him the option of having decompressive surgery because I felt that there was the potential to have a recovery. And fortunately, in Mr. Ruffalo's case, there has been substantial, albeit incomplete, recovery, but you know, there certainly has been improvement. And I think that John's case exemplifies the idea that even when you're, you know, conveying the facts of an injury or a serious disorder, that the clinician should always bear in mind how important it is for people to retain hope.
Dr. Hatcham, what inspired you to get into this field in the first place? And I'm curious what motivates you to continue every day.
I think really seeing, you know, the patient's front line is really the driving factor. As Dr. Failings mentioned, you know, we do early surgery, there are rehabilitation strategies, but we're still really looking for that treatment that could maybe reverse the injury and really allow significant regeneration. So I think seeing that day to day on the front lines in clinic is really the motivation for all the work that I'm doing. I first started out actually grade 12 in the lab with Dr. Tatter as a co-op student. What I was fascinated about was this concept of the body's own potential ability to regenerate the spinal cord. And we see that in other, you know, species, that is, these endogenous stem cells are one of the critical players that allow them to do that. But I think still at this point, we haven't yet found a way to really harness that. And so that's where I, you know, starting off in the lab, really wanted to focus my work. So throughout the PhD, we've been looking at these mechanisms. How can we really harness the body's own endogenous stem cells and synergistically use those cells with other treatments to try to regenerate, you know, lost circuitry?
I know one individual who had an impact on you personally, who you knew well, was Christopher Reeve. Right, Dr. Failing? So you had a chance to meet him and to get to know him. And I just wonder, based on everything we've talked about today, had Christopher had his injury today and science and research has progressed to a point that we're at currently, would he potentially have been able to walk again one day?
It's hard to say. Well, Chris was a big inspiration to me, and he was a great friend of the Toronto Western Hospital. You know, so would Christopher Reeve's outcome have been different? That's hard to say. He sustained a very severe injury and he underwent, you know, what at the time was very good treatment. But it's possible that perhaps with modern surgical care, modern advances in intensive care, targeted rehabilitation, it's possible that Chris may have had a somewhat better outcome, and perhaps he might even still be with us now. And what Chris's case also illustrates is that for people with particularly a cervical spinal cord injury, it can unfortunately shorten people's lives. And so advances in medical surgical care are not only important in terms of restoring quality of life and independence, but in a very realistic way are life-saving in that they will help to prolong people's lives.
Thank you both for joining me today. It's been a great conversation, and I hope you'll come back and tell us when there are updates.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure chatting.
Thanks so much to John Ruffalo for sharing his incredible story. Thanks also to Dr. Michael Failings and Dr. Lorene Hatcham for joining me on the podcast today. If you'd like to hear more about John's journey, head to our website, uhn.ca/Kremble, and click on the show notes for today's episode. This episode of Your Complex Brain was produced by Jessica Schmidt. Dr. Amy Ma is our executive producer. Thanks also to Kim Perry, Megan Anderi, Sarah Yuan, Liz Chapman, and Lorna Gilfeder for their production assistance.
If you enjoyed this episode of Your Complex Brain, please tell your family and friends. And don't forget to leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast listening app. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another exciting episode. Have a great day.